Hello and welcome to the EMG Health Podcast. I'm your host, Dr. Jonathan Sakia, and today I'm delighted to welcome our guest, Dr. Caroline Mickey, who's a consultant medical oncologist, honorary clinical senior lecturer, as well as breast cancer clinical trial lead at the Edinburgh Cancer Centre and University of Edinburgh Western General Hospital in Scotland, of course, one of my favourite places to visit in the world and where I lived for a few years. Caroline qualified in medicine from Aberdeen Medical School, obtaining numerous distinctions and prizes along the way. She was trained largely in Edinburgh, although she did spend 6 months in Adelaide in the south of Australia, followed by a spell at the Royal Marsden in London. She then obtained membership in the Royal College of Physicians, specialist registration in medical oncology, and then fellowship of the Royal College of Physicians of Edinburgh. Her thesis work focused on individualized therapy for epithelial ovarian cancer, one of the things we're going to discuss, correlating gene expression with clinical outcome. Caroline, welcome to the podcast.
Oh, thank you very much. It's a pleasure to be here. Thank you for having me.
Well, we're thrilled to have you. So I just want to start off with some background. As I said, I love Scotland. I lived in Glasgow for a few years during my surgical training. You live in an area of Scotland just outside Edinburgh known as the Kingdom of Fife, an ancient Pictish name that's been around since just after the Romans, I believe. For the benefit of those listeners who are not familiar with your country, what are some of the best things about living in Scotland?
Well, a lot of people do seem to love Scotland, actually, which is really nice. Wherever you go, there's a lot of love and affection for the country. It's pretty small. It's in the north part of the UK, and Edinburgh is the capital. And it's a particularly beautiful city, I think. I'm very biased, having grown up there. But there's a huge amount of culture in Edinburgh. There's the Edinburgh Festival every year, and lots of beautiful old buildings and architecture. But I think really the best thing about living in Scotland is that you can be in so many different places just within a few hours radius. We've got the beach, you've got the mountains, the countryside, the hills. So there's a lot of open space and it feels very accessible. The weather, unfortunately, is the downfall. And although it's April today, I do see a blizzard with some snow outside. But when the weather shines, there is no better place to be.
Well, you also didn't make any comment about the people. I find that the people in Scotland are so warm and welcoming, a very mischievous sense of humour. The food is rather damn good. And there's another thing they export from there that I have a particular penchant for. And I was told very early in my time there that if I ever called whiskey scotch, someone would take me around the back of the woodshed. It's whiskey.
There it's definitely whiskey.
Yeah, absolutely. So during your training, Caroline, you went to Australia and then London. What were the best things about your time in both those places? Very different to each other and very different to Edinburgh.
Yes, they both are. Australia was really just following what a lot of junior doctors do after their initial house jobs, as they were called back then. And there was a whole lot of us all went to Australia, New Zealand to get 6 months or a year of experience in a different healthcare system and do some traveling, have some nice weather. I never took a year out after school and went to university at 17. So it was quite young and it was something I definitely wanted to do before settling down into a full training program. So that was really good fun working there. There was great teaching in Adelaide and I had a few friends living in Sydney who I got to spend lots of time with as well. In London, I worked at the Royal Marsden twice, both before, just before my specialist training and then again in a post end of training fellowship just before I took up my consultant post. And that was just an amazing experience. For those of you that don't know, the Royal Marsden Hospital is certainly one of the world's most famous cancer hospitals, and it's a really inspirational place. It's a world-class centre of excellence, and there's so much diversity in the people that work there. A lot of oncologists around the world come over to London to be trained at the Royal Marsden. And when I was living there the second time, it was during the Olympics in London, and it was a fabulous time to be in London. It was really great. But I've always enjoyed the bright lights and the culture and the different opportunities that London offers. So they were both fantastic experiences. And it's nice to have done that before settling down to have a family.
It's always, frankly, as a doctor, it's always good to see different parts of the world and to sense different people, different cultures, different experiences. I think it really helps in dealing with patients. So I'm always told that I should never discuss politics, but part of it is kind of interesting. So although currently Scotland is part of the United Kingdom, who knows what the future is going to bring, the National Health Service runs very differently than National Health Service England. For instance, in England, there are 223 trusts which manage areas of the health service, whereas Scotland's got 14 boards, one special board, and a single public health body. What works well there, in your opinion, compared to your southern Sassenach neighbours, as you guys call us southerners?
Well, I think, excuse me, I'm not sure I have the best personal insight into this, because the Royal Marsden was one of the original NHS Foundation trusts in England, and it's an incredibly high-achieving trust. So I don't think it probably represents the average NHS England trust. So at the Marsden, things work extremely well. So I'm not sure I have the right comparison experience to offer. But Scotland is, or certainly historically, used to be called the sick man of Europe, partly because of high smoking rates and obesity and poor diet. So my understanding is that actually per head of population, significantly more funding goes into in the health system in Scotland, partly because it's needed. And if you look objectively, the A&E turnaround time rates are better in Scotland and England quite consistently. But
yeah, so A&E, just for our overseas visitors, that's the same as the ER, the emergency, accidents and emergency.
Yeah. But I think actually, if you look, some of the key targets are better met in England than in Scotland, and surgical weights might be better there too. So I'm not totally sure we make the best of being quite a small country. The population of Scotland is slightly less than the population of Yorkshire in England. So we should be able to speak to each other and work more cohesively. And I think we often do that. But unfortunately, we don't all have the same IT systems, which is such a shame. And this comes up time and time again in meetings. If only we had the same system, we could pull all the data very quickly, and very quickly you'd have data for a population of 5.5 million people. But unfortunately, the boards have all generally selected different IT systems. And I think that's been a real shame, to be honest. But it's a lovely place to work. And I really enjoy it.
Well, the comment about IT systems, I mean, that's a whole podcast in and of itself. But, you know, the old joke, there's no N in the, there's no national in the National Health Service. It is down to, you know, I guess think globally, but act locally. Sometimes we ought to act globally. So another terminology issue, you previously served as a Macmillan consultant medical oncologist at NHS Fife, the Victoria Hospital in Kirkcaldy, which I know. For those unfamiliar with the term, tell us about the Macmillan Trust and the work they do, and how does philanthropic support gel with a health system which is largely paid for through taxation?
Yeah, it's a very good question. So I was an oncologist in Fife, which is, let's say, where I live, actually. And the way oncology is set up in the UK is that primarily the oncologists are based at the bigger cancer centres, because that's where the big radiotherapy machines are based. We don't have these in all different hospitals. So patients often have to travel quite far for radiotherapy, and they become the hub, as it were, of the cancer centre for that network. So Edinburgh is the main centre in the southeast of Scotland, and we serve four different other trusts. So a bit like a hub and spoke type of setup, where Edinburgh is the middle and then the oncologists go out to the district to provide oncological support. And for most of these places, there are chemotherapy units, so patients can have treatment locally to home, but for radiotherapy they would have to travel. So in Fife, I was a consultant there primarily to set up a new service, which I think we might come on to. But Macmillan is a charity that's been going for over 100 years. And it was set up by a chap called Douglas Macmillan, I think it was in 1911. His father was diagnosed with cancer at a time where people didn't talk about cancer. There was very little support, very little understanding, and he felt something had to be done. Sadly, he died of cancer himself, I think, in the 1960s. But what he'd done is he set up this cancer support charity, which was initially called the National Society for Cancer Relief. And it became a really key part of the hospice movement over the next 100 years. And primarily they offer support for patients, but also support for professionals, and provide fantastic resources with patient information. So Macmillan, they have their own paid staff, but they also support other oncology related professionals. So primarily nurses, but a few doctors or physiotherapists, for example, to try to build a nationwide network and provide resources and education, so we can all work in partnership together. And it's a mutually beneficial relationship, and that those that are supported by Macmillan would then signpost patients to Macmillan, and most of where their money comes from is through fundraising. So it's a fantastic charity that's one of Britain's best loved charities. They provide all sorts of help and support, food, grants. In the old days it was for grants for coal, grants for holidays, but now they still do Macmillan grants for patients who are struggling financially with cancer. So they're a fantastic charity. And they didn't pay me, but they helped support my role and offered me additional education and resources to help use in that role.
That's wonderful. Yeah, it is an amazing charity with very, very wide-reaching effects, as you say, well-loved. So thinking about roles, you planned, set up, and then led the development of the acute oncology service, also in Fife, the first acute oncology service in Scotland in 2015, I believe. Tell us about that experience.
Well, oncologists have obviously been delivering chemotherapy for quite a long time now. And in 2008, there was a national, an English national inquiry called the NCPOD inquiry. And that looked into increased mortality in patients who'd received systemic therapies, so chemotherapy or some of our targeted treatments or antibodies. And they saw that patients who were admitted to these district general hospitals sometimes didn't necessarily get the best care that they could have. And a panel of experts looked through the notes of many, many patients. I can't quite remember how many, but the clinical care was criticised in around 40% of those cases, partly due to not having the right treatment protocols, or because these patients, although they were under the care of an oncologist from the centre, they were often admitted acutely in their local hospital, which perhaps didn't have the expertise required to help reduce the risk of treatment-related death. And that really was the start of this acute oncology phenomenon. It wasn't something people had heard of before. And now most of the big district general hospitals in England, where they have an emergency room, they have to have an acute oncology service to try to reduce morbidity and mortality from anti-cancer therapy. We know that if you have chemotherapy and you're unwell, it's very important you get antibiotics very quickly if you have a fever, for example. And so acute oncology services tend to be a key part of setting up easily accessible, up-to-date treatment protocols in all these district general hospitals. And usually they have a nurse or a consultant-led service who would do a daily ward round across the hospital of new cancer patients that had been admitted. And there's a number of different parts to acute oncology. Some of it is patients who are admitted with emergency presentation of cancer, and we know that some of these patients don't do very well. And some people are admitted because of their treatment, and some are admitted because of something completely separate, like an MI, for example. But that may well have implications for their ongoing cancer treatment. So it's important to have very open communication channels. And that's really what an acute oncology service does. It's about trying to pick up any cancer patient who's admitted acutely and try to make sure that everyone's talking to each other and they get the best possible care. So I set up the first one in Scotland, having been to see a number of different acute oncology services that had started in England already. And I think we have set up a really great service, and now because I look after all the ladies in Fife who have chemotherapy for breast cancer. I'm one of their biggest customers, as it were, now, and I'm really very proud of the fantastic work that the team do. We've got some fabulous nursing staff who are so experienced, and they just do a brilliant job. So that was my first experience of really setting up a new service, and I think a lot of people often comment on how good the team is, so that's great.
Well, we're going to come on and talk about one aspect of that in this time of COVID, but we'll circle back to that. I want to carry on with your fascinating career development, and talking about that, you're an NRS Career Development Fellow for 2018 through to this year, with a focus on clinical trials in breast cancer. What does that actually mean? What are you going to achieve in this role?
Yeah, us doctors, we love all our acronyms, don't we?
So the NRS. I'm trying to work out like alternative meanings for the acronyms. That's me being childish.
So NRS stands for NHS Research Scotland, and actually this has been a fantastic system that was set up by the Chief Scientist Office, which is linked to the Scottish Government. And they realised that there was a real need to try to support NHS clinicians who might really want to do research and try and give them some protected time. And certainly in cancer, we know that patients who are involved in clinical research actually do better. And there's also good research that clinicians who are involved more intensively in research or in other activities tend to have less burnout. So it's a win-win situation. The clinicians feel more fulfilled, that they're doing extra things, but also that the patients hopefully are gaining from that as well. So every year there's a call for applicants for consultants in their first 5 years of being a consultant, and you can apply for one or two clinical sessions a week that would be funded by the Chief Scientist's Office. So I was very lucky to apply for that and was offered one. I had a quick look, and they tend to support around 15 or so fellows each year across Scotland. And they don't have to be doctors, they can be allied health professionals as well. And my particular proposal was officially termed Improving Real World Outcomes in Breast Cancer through Novel Therapeutics. And essentially, I feel really passionately that my patients in Fife, I can see, are a little bit different to my patients in Edinburgh. One of my real priorities is trying to reduce inequality between the two. So I'm trying to set up more clinical research in Fife with the hope of improving those outcomes for those patients. And in Edinburgh, we're quite lucky that lots of pharmaceutical companies have worked with our team for years. So we get offered a number of different clinical trials, and it's about picking out the right ones that we can recruit well to that also offer something better for patients. So clinical trials are often where in oncology we get the earliest access to some of these new drugs that are coming through, often 2 years, maybe even more than that, before they actually make it into the fully approved NHS market. So that's really my aim, is to try to improve those outcomes, get more patients in Fife into clinical trials. But I also run the Edinburgh team, so we have even more exciting, more novel drugs coming through the Edinburgh network, and my Fife patients can then take advantage of that. And if they're happy to travel to Edinburgh, then we can offer them those trials as well. So it's not just about the Fife patients, it's also about Edinburgh. But that's my real goal, is to try to reduce inequalities.
Yeah, and I mean, it's a bit of a sort of a trope, isn't it, that the people who have the best access to the care in general, the people who don't need it as much as those who don't have the best access. So it's a self-fulfilling prophecy. Continuing the theme of trials, tell us about the South East Scotland Breast Cancer Clinical Trial Team.
Okay. Well, in Edinburgh, as part of our cancer centre, there are different teams, and they're batched according to how busy those teams are. So just with breast cancer being such a huge tumour type, we're a team on our own. And there's a lot of different clinical trials running through our network. So any patient from any of our network can be referred into us, but also we take referrals from Glasgow or from Forth Valley, from Dundee, if patients wanted to be referred down to Edinburgh to access some of these novel drugs. And with the internet, you know, patients often are very well versed and educated on what the new latest drug of excitement is. So they want to be referred for these clinical studies. So my role is just to lead the team, and I keep an eye on our portfolio. And for those that aren't familiar with breast cancer, there's a number of different subtypes. And generally, clinical trials are not run for all breast cancer subtypes nowadays, particularly metastatic disease. So we have different subtype-driven drugs. And so it's my role to make sure that there's a clinical trial available in each of the main subtypes at any stage of someone's cancer journey. So we'd have what we call triple negative breast cancer, which is estrogen receptor, progesterone receptor, and HER2 negative breast cancer. So we want to make sure we've got clinical trials available for that group. We also want to make sure there's trials available for the estrogen receptor positive group and also the HER2 positive group, because these drugs, they work in different ways, and these are separate diseases in themselves. So the clinical trials increasingly are very subtype specific. That does make things more challenging for running them in smaller centres like in Fife, because you need to still be able to recruit well to these studies to make it worthwhile. So I keep an eye on the data managers and the research nurses, make sure that they are coping in terms of their workload, and we have regular meetings. And as soon as new clinical trials open, we then have a new education meeting to educate everybody about the study, and then continue to review our portfolio regularly.
I mean, it's fantastic as medicine becomes more and more precise, precision medicine, personalized medicine. It's obviously important that that we have the appropriate research data to support this decision making, and with a degree of geographic relevance, because, you know, who knows what role geography or specific genotypes may play in the way things behave. So good on you. Look, I've had a pressing question I wanted to ask you. You know the old aphorism that 5 years after you leave med school, 50% of what you learned will have been proven to be incorrect. Problem is, we don't know which 50%. And I've been out of medical school so damn long, I don't think anything I was taught was correct. So part of that common wisdom states that somewhere under 1% of breast cancers develop in men. Well, given that zero is somewhere under 1%, I think during my career, I only recall one case. How common is breast cancer in truth in men? And what does this teach us about the etiology of male and female breast cancer?
No, I think you're right, actually. It is extremely rare still. I only have one man on my caseload at the moment. And if you look at the statistics, it's about 350 men a year in the UK are diagnosed with breast cancer versus 55,000 women. So it is a huge difference there. In terms of the risk factors, increasing age is the main risk factor for male breast cancer. But there is definitely more genetic related breast cancer, particularly BRCA2, so BRCA2 in men. Interestingly, men who have a higher estrogen state, so somebody who might have cirrhosis or obesity, we know that estrogen is stored in fat, they are at higher risk. Or patients who've perhaps had radiotherapy for Hodgkin's disease, where the breast tissue has been in the field, they would be at risk as well. So in some ways, those are all risk factors for female breast cancer as well. But clearly, the estrogen levels are going to be much higher in women throughout their life than men. But I think that's really quite interesting about the obesity.
Yeah, so obviously with the epidemic of obesity, and I think something like 25% increase in body mass index over the past 25 years, presumably we're going to be seeing a lot more.
Potentially, yeah.
Yeah, and a follow-on in some ways. We know that human papillomavirus strains are involved in the genesis of cervical and oropharyngeal cancers, and that's led to vaccination programs. So first part of this question is, what's the take-up of these vaccines in a world where the anti-vaxxer movement is common? And are we going to see these cancers fade away? Is it going to be a successful vaccination project, and are other cancers going to be proven to have a viral cause? You can see I'm trying to cram as many questions as possible.
Well, certainly that is our hope, that the cervical cancer will become a thing of the past. Scotland actually has been at the forefront of the vaccination programme, and uptake in Scotland is over 90% for all three doses. It started in the UK, I think, didn't it, the cervical cancer vaccination programme in around 2008. And the BMJ ran a paper last year, I think, with the Scottish data, which showed nearly a 90% reduction in the highest cervical CIN3, so the highest level of CIN before it becomes a cancer or worse, in girls who are vaccinated. So I think we think that this is just going, hopefully, as long as there is good take up, it is going to hugely change the landscape of cervical cancer, which still is the second most common cancer in women under 35. So I hope the anti-vaxxers won't get too much in the way. I don't think we certainly have that too often in Scotland, but I know in America in particular, there's quite a strong movement. And there are some of the connotations about the etiology of cervical cancer and what the vaccine is trying to protect girls against that some people might object to. I'm not sure if there's cultural objections or not. It's not something I've come across. But we do know that the earlier the vaccine is given, the more protective it is. So that's why it is important to get in earlier, if possible. And in terms of other viruses, I think we don't really know. There's so much we don't know about cancer, and that's what makes it fascinating, is that in the last 10 years, last 15 years, even last 20 years, there's just so much we've learned about it. So it will be interesting to see if we do find any other viral-driven cancers. But as you say, the oropharyngeal ones are also significantly associated with the virus itself, which is why we're looking to try to vaccinate boys as well as girls.
So there was, I recall, Burkitt's lymphoma and the Epstein-Barr mm-hmm. virus and glandular fever, and that if you're in Africa, you get a lymphoma. If you're in London, you feel a bit crappy for a few weeks.
Yeah, it's interesting, isn't it? I don't have that answer for you.
Yeah, well, I mean, it just goes back to my observation that there is locality is important. And if you look in the regulatory field at the moment, European regulators are saying that they want data on European patients. American regulators want data on American patients, and so on and so forth. So maybe they're right. Who knows? So I want to stay with the theme of obviously of cancer, but moving to a different part of the body. And I always try to find links with where my guest comes from. So a fellow Celt, Pierce Brosnan, Irish, tragically lost both his first wife, Cassandra, and her daughter from a prior marriage to ovarian cancer. And Cassandra had lost her mother to the same wretched disease. What are the current guidelines on genetic screening for cancer? Because it makes you think, my goodness, did they do the right thing by Cassandra and certainly by her daughter? What are the current guidelines on genetic screening for cancer? And could they be improved?
I think they definitely could be improved. And I suspect, because the world is changing so quickly at the moment, that all of us will know our BRCA 1 and BRCA 2 status within the next 10 to certainly 20 years. So I think we'll have a lot more knowledge about our genes. When I started in oncology, it used to take 2 years to get a BRCA1 and 2 result back. So it wasn't very helpful in terms of changing your management, and we hardly ever did them. So we certainly are testing a lot more patients now. We tend to use something called the Manchester scoring system for BRCA1 and 2. And in the last year, we've extended our panel, as has most places in the UK, to another 6 different genes. What I would say, and we always have to consent patients to, is that we actually don't know quite as much about the other genes that we're testing for, and therefore the relevance of the results is sometimes a bit questionable. So patients actually do sign a form to say, I understand there may well be uncertainty and that more information may become available as that knowledge is gathered. And I think there's going to be such an explosion in knowledge when it comes to cancer genetics over the next 20 years. So for us, we have quite a low threshold to test patients for breast cancer. If anyone's got a triple negative breast cancer, they tend to be a little bit higher in terms of those that have BRCA1 and 2 mutations, or if someone has a strong family history, as per this Manchester scoring system, or if someone had bilateral disease, if they were both under 60 years of age, we automatically do their BRCA testing with their consent. And for ovarian cancer, a lot more has been identified about that in the last 10 to 15 years. And it's been so important because of the development of some amazing drugs called PARP inhibitors that I was involved with at a really very early stage in my career. And they've really revolutionized the treatment of ovarian cancer recently. And essentially any patient who's got a high-grade serous ovarian cancer, which is the most common pathological subtype, is usually offered BRCA 1 and 2 testing now. Whenever you find somebody who has one of these mutations, they're then eligible for PARP inhibitors, depending where they are in the cancer pathway. But it's not just about BRCA 1 and 2. Also, a lot of patients with high-grade serous ovarian cancer have sort of somatic abnormalities in homologous recombination repair, and they behave very like patients with BRCA mutations. Probably the paper that I'm most proud of was one of the papers we published in the Journal of Clinical Oncology during my research time, and that showed that patients who have ovarian cancer, if they then have disease in one of the viscera, so liver, lung, or brain metastases, that was a real marker of being a genetic BRCA 1 or 2 mutation carrier. And that's even been extended out more recently to something called BRCA-ness. So if you have a cancer that behaves a bit like a BRCA patient, but you don't carry a BRCA mutation, you've probably got homologous recombination repair deficiency, but that's called BRCA-ness, so to be like BRCA. And that really changed management for quite a lot of patients around that time, that if you saw someone who had an intraparenchymal liver metastasis, that was a big flag. They probably carried a BRCA mutation. Nowadays they're all tested, so it probably doesn't change things very much. But what it did show us is that these cancers do behave differently. There's a different mechanism of spread as well. So again, they're separate diseases.
So we used to be taught, didn't we, genotype is not phenotype. Well, maybe for cancers, that's not the case. But I guess there's a central message here. Know your family history. And I certainly tell any patient, you know, a very good way to spend an hour is to map out your family history and what people died of and what diseases they had, because it might inform your future. So years ago, I was involved in some research looking at cellular membrane transport with the aim of trying to develop a blood test for cancer. And then I invested in a company that had aimed to bring an ECG-like technology to market to diagnose breast cancer. The research went nowhere. I lost my investment. Both failed. What's the latest and greatest in breast cancer diagnosis?
Well, I guess a really good question, and there's just so much out there. I wouldn't profess to know everything that's on the table and being developed at the moment. But one I would suggest would be, it seems to be quite far down the development pathway, are some of these early detection tests. And the Galeri test, which is it's made by certainly the program and the website is called the GRAIL, so GRAIL, and it's looking at circulating tumor cells and trying to identify patients at the very earliest asymptomatic stage for up to 50 different cancers. And I think it's about to start in clinical trials across NHS England in the next few months. Certainly it's planned to start mid-2021, looking doing an annual blood test for 3 years in people who are 50 to 79, looking to see, can we pick up these cancers at these very early asymptomatic stages, and is this going to translate into improved survival? You know, the NHS long-term plan for England is to try to aim to increase stage 1 and 2 cancers at diagnosis to 75% before even 2030. So it's quite an optimistic and challenge to set oneself. And I think this is probably the way we hope to go. But if we look back to some of the other trials in the past, there was this really well-led study, I think it was by the MRC, called the OVO5 study in ovarian cancer. And what it did is it randomised patients who, so everybody got their CA125 checked. I think it was 3 monthly. But people were blinded to the result in one group. And they only started further chemotherapy if they were symptomatic. And the other group, their CA125 was known, and as soon as the CA125 reached a certain level, the trial team were alerted, and the aim was to try to start chemotherapy at an earlier asymptomatic stage. And we all hoped, and indeed probably expected, that that study would be positive, and it wasn't. And so that was quite a blow to solid tumour oncology as a whole, just thinking that even if we're picking it up at the earliest point, it didn't make a difference. And in breast cancer, we have a few trials now running. And it's one of the more novel ways to start running trials of new drugs that have been proven to be effective in metastatic disease. And then we often then start using them in the neoadjuvant, so the pre-op or the adjuvant setting. But adjuvant trials take such a long time to get results, particularly in breast cancer, where the relapses might happen as late as 10, even 15 years or even later. So it's not easy to get those results back quickly. And so one strategy people are doing with clinical trials at the moment is finding the higher risk group, they're in remission, and once they've completed all their standard treatment, they then go into a program of getting blood tests checked at regular intervals, looking for a rise in circulating tumor cells or CTCs. And then the idea is to try to bring in a novel drug to see if we can change the long-term outcome. So in triple negative breast cancer, we've completed recruitment, but we don't have any data yet, for a study called the CTRAC study, which is tracking people's CTCs for a year after their adjuvant chemotherapy was complete. And the idea was that if their CTCs rose, then we would start some immunotherapy, but patients would be randomised. So half the group would not get immunotherapy and half would. And the idea was to see that if this drug could actually make a genuine difference in terms of improving the cure rate for these patients. So that data is all to come, but it's really interesting. So I think I would definitely look at the GRAIL early detection test. And I'll be watching that study very carefully over the next 5 to 10 years when the data hopefully comes through.
I hope it's sooner rather than later.
I know. But in terms of whether it ends in cure, these things always take a long time. But
I know. Well, you get signals and
we'll
have to have you back and say, look, if something's encouraging, and I always find when I listen to these things at a conference and someone says, well, it's encouraging, but it's not definitive. We need to wait and see. I cannot restrain myself. I get up, grab the microphone and say, well, what would you do with your family member?
Right? Yeah.
Yeah, that's always the telling thing. So switching tack a little bit, the COVID-19 pandemic, as we know, has killed many, made many more sick and interfered with the provision of care for many other diseases. And cancer patients have definitely been impacted. Tell us how and what role you've played in mitigating those issues.
It's been a really difficult year for cancer patients, as it has for everybody. But I feel really passionately that our patients have really had a lot of additional anxiety and challenges to put up with, actually. Right from the very beginning, from the delays in diagnosis, it certainly has been harder to see GPs. That's not a criticism of GPs, but we are seeing patients coming through now that perhaps were too frightened to see their GP. Perhaps they didn't want to bother anyone. They were listening to the message, stay home. Or perhaps it was just a few telephone consultations and actually they weren't able to tease out what the real problem was and weren't able to have proper examination. So we are definitely, unfortunately, seeing delays in diagnosis. There have also been delays in some key diagnostics like endoscopies and CT scans. Surgery also has been delayed for a number of different tumour types, and in particular if they needed to use intensive care for their post-op recovery. So the neurosurgical, the brain tumour patients, bowel cancer patients, the complex ovarian cancer surgery, those type of cancers surgery definitely had a big pause for quite a few months. And we did see that in our wards with patients who probably should have had an operation 2 or 3 months before, which was sad to see. In breast cancer, we were quite lucky in that the surgery's usually a lot more straightforward, although you wouldn't want me operating on you, that's for sure. But we were able to exploit partnerships with private hospitals in a number of different hospitals across the UK. So the private hospitals stopped doing their routine private work, but they became COVID cold, or a green site, as it were. And they were allowing NHS operations to be done on their on their ground, so the patients could be kept separate from the hot red sites, as it were. So most of my patients actually had their operations as planned. I tend to look after quite a lot of patients with the more aggressive breast cancers by definition, because I give the chemotherapy. Some of our patients went on to neoadjuvant, so upfront letrozole to try to block estrogen to see if that would help temporize the situation until the operations could be done. But our patients who had the estrogen negative cancers, they were prioritized and they went on to have their operations very promptly. But I think what I see day in, day out with my patients is just how difficult the whole year has been with the reduced support network. And I remember this lovely lady who had a life-limiting cancer, and she was a very family-orientated lady. And she looked me in the eye and she said, "You know, Dr. Mickey, these were really, really precious months for me. And I haven't been able to see my grandchildren. I haven't even met my new grandson. And this is, it's just breaking my heart." And that's been really hard. And I think just not our patients not having their normal support network has made everything much more difficult. And we can see that with the number of calls coming to our clinical support nurses. Our nurse specialists are definitely busier than even normal. And I think having cancer at any point, and having chemotherapy in particular, it's always a stressful time. But to have that additional anxiety about a global pandemic, when you go in for your surgery, when you go to have your scan, when you go for your chemotherapy, you're being immunosuppressed. What does that mean for me? It's been really difficult. And then to the other end of the spectrum, the end of life care has changed quite a bit. And patients have not necessarily been able to have their family visiting them until the very last hours or days of life. And that's been hugely traumatic for lots of families. The community teams have really stepped in. And from a very personal perspective, we looked after my mother-in-law for 4 months, not with cancer actually, but with end-stage COPD. And she sadly died just at the end of 2020. But the community team said that there has been a real drive to push for end-of-life care at home. And they've put in a lot of provision to try to make sure that if somebody wants to die at home, that all the provisions are made rapidly. And I think that was something that people hoped to do anyway, but this has really driven that forward. So that's actually in the end been a good thing. But I think when I'm on call and I'm on the wards and you see families who can't visit their relatives, it feels a bit inhumane at times.
Yeah, I was just going to say, number one, I'm sorry for your loss, and one can hear in your voice the compassion that you obviously have for your patients. I mean, there are structural things we can do, but sometimes just holding someone's hand and being kind is so important.
Absolutely.
You know, Caroline, I like to ask all my guests this sort of question. And given you've done medical missionary work in Rwanda, Tanzania, Zimbabwe, if you woke up tomorrow morning and discovered that you were cancer supremo for the entire world, what three things would you do just before we close?
Gosh, no pressure. I think trying to roll out the HPV vaccine quickly would be one of my biggest ones, actually. In sub-Saharan Africa, the breast and cervical cancer cause about 1 in 5 cancer deaths. And you know, cervical cancer increasingly we're seeing as a potentially preventable illness. And 25% of cancer cases in some of the low and middle income countries are HPV related. So that would be the first thing I would do. The second thing, I would try to exploit how good it is that we have the internet now. And I remember being on my honeymoon in Kenya, and we flew in a little plane and landed on a little landing strip in the middle of nowhere. And this Maasai Mara warrior was standing underneath a tree looking at us, and he had his classic red formal dress on, and round his belt he had a very fancy iPhone. And it was certainly much better than any phone I had. And I was teaching in, I think it was in Rwanda, actually, when they just realised how much better the internet was there. They had 4G long before we had it in 5, that's for sure. So I think we have a real ability to exploit that technology. Everybody in Africa has phones, and a lot of them have smartphones, so we can get education out to them rapidly, both for patients and also healthcare professionals. And what we were doing when I was in Rwanda and Tanzania recently was about trying to educate the doctors on the ground about cancer. And for a lot of them, when they were at medical school, cancer was just the small print at the bottom of the page. And it's a bit like me having a ward full of patients with dengue fever. I wouldn't have a clue how to look after them. And now we know that cancer is the single biggest rising healthcare problem in Africa. So it's about not just the patients, but also healthcare professionals and the politicians. So I think trying to do something with cancer education through technology would be really helpful. And I know there's a lot of talk about AI at the moment and how that can help us with improving data and diagnostics. It's also going to help us hopefully with drug discovery and genomic characterization and things. But what can we do to try to get as much information out as possible? And when I went to Rwanda, before I flew there, I looked at a map of Africa, looking at what the different most common cancer types were. And there was a little blip for Rwanda and Burundi next to it. And I thought, well, it's not that there's going to be no cancer there, but it's of course because they have no cancer registry. And if you don't have a cancer registry, if you don't know what your incidence is, then you need that to drive cancer policy. So I think trying to help those countries utilize the internet and information technology to try to drive forward their cancer policy, because they don't have the infrastructure in a lot of these countries in order to run big cancer centers. There's one radiotherapy machine in Rwanda. I think there's one in Uganda. And the vast majority of patients, they can't get to where they need to get to. So it's a huge national problem, and it's about trying to deal with their transport and infrastructure as well as the education. But I think the first step would be to try to get patients to present early and for the doctors to understand what they might be dealing with, and that early awareness is important, and try to get these patients to the cancer centres. But they may well be many, many hours away from a lot of these patients. So there's a huge challenge ahead. So I think those are some of the things that I would do.
Well, it should be no surprise that that your ideas are well conceived and driven by compassion. And as one of my mentors taught me, if we put the patient at the center of everything we do, we won't go far wrong. That's all that's all we have time for today. Dr. Caroline Mihie, I want to thank you. You're an absolutely fascinating and delightful guest, and the patients in Fife are clearly very lucky to have you. I just wish we could get together and have a wee dram to celebrate.
Absolutely.
After this, maybe hopefully soon. So Caroline, thank you.
Thank you very much for having me. Thank you for listening.
It's been delightful. So folks, if you've enjoyed this episode and you're new to us, you can hear all prior podcasts by Googling EMG Health Podcasts or wherever you get your podcasts. And you can write to me with suggested topics, questions, or I guess criticisms at drjonathansakia@gmail.com. So spelled out, that's Dr. Dr. Jonathan, J-O-N-A-T-H-A-N, Sakia, S-A-C-K-I-R, drjonathansakia@gmail.com. And if you enjoyed this, please tell your colleagues and friends and like us on social media. And if you didn't enjoy this, well, I'm sorry, but maybe consider joining us next week for another episode of the EMG Health Podcast. Bye for now.